today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Tyler Mahan Coe joins us for an interview.
Oh, that's cool. I guess he made bail? So, Patrick, you just got back from a trip.
I did, Jim. I went on an airplane and everything all by myself.
Oh, wow. They let you on the airplanes now?
They did. Yeah. It was good. I have to fly either very early in the morning or very late at night, but it worked out okay.
Okay, good. And where did you go?
I went to Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Music City.
Yeah, and I was able to combine a little work trip with a little Rockin' the Suburbs trip.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It worked out really well.
Right, so... This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And while you were in Nashville, who'd you meet?
I met Tyler Mahan Coe, Jim.
Okay.
He is the host of an amazing podcast, music podcast, country music podcast, called Cocaine and Rhinestones.
Yes, I've listened to it, and it's great.
Cool. Yeah, it's really, really good. He just completed season one, Tyler, and he... really did an amazing job, and his ambition is very great. He really wants to tell the entire history of country music in a podcast.
Yeah. What's great about it is that it's not like he's telling some chronological history and like making it an encyclopedia kind of thing. It's more like just these stories from different eras, different periods, kind of jumps around, but they're just like these really compelling little stories in each episode.
Yeah, exactly. And Tyler has a fairly well-known father. His father is David Allen Coe, who's kind of been an outsider in Nashville for several different reasons. He's generally been pretty anti-establishment Nashville. He's the author of the song Take This Job and Shove It,
right,
which Johnny Paycheck made into a really big hit.
Right.
And he's also written a tremendous amount of really well-known songs and been covered by a lot of people and had a very long career playing and singing. And Tyler was in his band for many years. So Tyler, when he says on his podcast that he's been hearing these stories about country music his whole life, he's telling the truth. Like, he's been on the road,
right,
you know, for more than 10 years with his dad and sort of hung out and heard a lot of that kind of stuff and was around a lot of famous, you know, right, country music people.
One of the things I'm really impressed by with Tyler's podcast is, and we should think about this sometime,
okay,
is he actually seems to do research.
I know, it's crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. And he actually transcribes every episode and puts it on the internet too. And you'll hear him talk about the fact that he has hearing trouble from being in a high powered, you know, sort of redneck rock band for a long time.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So the first part of the interview that we're going to play today is more about his background as a musician and growing up in a music family, right?
Right. Yeah. You'll hear him talk about one of his earliest memories is being on Ralph Emery's TV show at the age of 4 with his dad and doing a duet. And it goes from there. But I wanted to get this stuff so everybody can kind of understand who Tyler is and where he got to the point where he began to make Cocaine and Rhinestones.
And one thing I will tell our listeners, and I think Tyler has mentioned that he makes this an aspiration of his podcast, is that even if you are not particularly a fan of country music or in your mind you think like, I just don't like country music, I think you're going to like a lot of his stories and a lot of what the podcast is all about, because it's just really great history and there's a lot of culture in it and you learn a lot about sort of the people and the times and the environment and, you know, and the way that sort of music is interwoven with that and sort of reflects back upon it. It's really great stuff. So, okay. So should we get to the interview here with Tyler?
Let's jump into it.
All right.
The old man was covered with tattoos and scars. He got some in prison and others in bars. The rest he got working on old junk cars in the daytime. They look like tombstones in our yard, and I never seen him when he wasn't tired and mean. He sold used parts to make ends meet, covered with grease from his head to his feet, cussing the sweat and the Texas heat and mosquitoes. And the neighbors said we live like hicks, but they brung their cars for Paul to fix beginning.
All right. I am here, listeners, in Nashville with Tyler Mahan. Co. Tyler, thank you very much for taking some of your time out to talk to me and rocking the suburbs.
Yeah, man. Hey, everyone. This is what my voice sounds like.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. You have a father who is a musician, and were you born here in Nashville?
No, I wasn't born in Nashville. I was actually born in Michigan. See, I told you to be careful about these questions because that's a very long story.
Okay, let's hear it. I'm ready. I'm ready if you are.
I would call my father more of an entertainer than just like a musician, just because here in Nashville, musician can mean just a session musician or anything like that. Right. He was a major label recording artist, not an A-list celebrity or anything. You either know who he is and care a lot, or you've never heard of him, is basically how that goes.
And that's David Allan Coe, for those who might not know.
Yeah. Exactly. And my mother came to Nashville with the express intention of marrying him and started spending a lot of time with him. And then it kind of didn't seem like it was going to work out. And she went home, but she was pregnant with me. So that's why I was born in Michigan. And then my birth got them back together. They were married for, you know, over a decade, I think. And I have three younger siblings, so more kids and all that stuff. And that's also how I came to live a life of country music, just from beginning to now.
So when that life began, what's the earliest musical memory that you have?
I don't know. You know, they say if you can get hypnotized and remember being in the womb, I'm certain it would be then, you know, it's just an ever-present thing. It would be like someone asking you, do you remember the first drink of water that you had or something like that? There was this show that used to be on TNN called Nashville Now that was hosted by Ralph Emery, just a national talk show. I remember being on that. I was performing on that when I was young, probably close to 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old. I remember, you know, bright lights, cue cards, a lot of people. And my father had already had me performing with him on stage before then, though. So there are earlier memories of bright lights and a lot of people, you know.
And what were you doing on stage?
We did this duet. There's a Bobby Bear. It's not, he didn't write it, but I think the most popular cut of the song is Bobby Bear with his son, Bobby Bear Jr. And the song is called Daddy What If. And so we just did that.
Daddy, boy, the wind stopped blowing. What happened then?
Why, if the wind stopped blowing, then the land would be dry. And your boat wouldn't sail, and son, your kite wouldn't fly. And the grass would see your troubles, and she'd tell the wind, and the wind would start blowing again.
And it was a really popular part of his stage show, so we did it for a long time. The running joke within the crew was that he fired me because it was such a popular part of the show. It would get a standing ovation. And then where do you go from there in the middle of a show? Like, you're not supposed to get the standing ovation right there.
You were upstaging him there.
And he didn't want to close with it because it's a real tearjerker and it ends on a huge bummer of a note and everything. So
didn't want everyone going home bummed out. Yeah. So was your dad gone a lot? Kind of in your formative years, your elementary school and sort of middle school years?
Well, yeah, but I would also go on tour in the summer.
You would?
So yeah,
okay.
It was, you know, gone, but then also a lot of time, because when you're on tour, it's concentrated time together. You know, it's just, it's like if you didn't dilute the orange juice thing, you know, you're just, you're only around the crew.
And would you characterize your growing up as, for a kid who, you know, you're probably not alone in this situation, whose father was working in the music industry and touring, would you say your upbringing was fairly normal in that sense, that you, you know, you went out in the summer, but your school was, you know, still something that happened? And
you mean like for other entertainers?
Yeah, I think relatively, like, right? I mean, obviously for somebody living, you know, in another part of the country where music wasn't such a central industry.
I don't know. I would say one key difference would be how much of a drive my father had to make his family a part of the show. You know, I think that he was taking me on these talk shows and had me performing on stage. I think he wanted to get me used to being in front of big crowds of people. And he did that to varying degrees with the other kids too. And with my mother also, he had her in the band, even though she hated it. She didn't want to do it at all, but he pushed her to do it.
What would you say was his motivation for having a sort of a family show? Was there somebody he was influenced by that also did that?
I would say for sure it's that. I think the way that it looked, but also I think that it was someone could read that as cynical in that way, and I don't think it really was cynical. I think it was more of a just a drive to involve the people that he cares about, you know, not necessarily that he thought being famous was such a great thing or whatever, but just that he wanted people around him who he felt like he could trust. I would say that his life has been one of not feeling like he could trust very many people, you know, and so getting screwed over by business people left and right. If you can get your family involved as much as possible, you know, you would like to think that that could cut down on things like that.
Absolutely. And certainly you could understand what you were just saying about his approach and some of the songs he wrote, right? And his attitude sort of toward industry in general, right?
Yeah.
He wrote a pretty famous song.
Several. I mean, his professional existence has in many ways been driven by vengeance almost, I would say. You know, initially it was vengeance toward the American system, which failed him as a child who had emotional problems, like intense emotional problems, before that was a thing that was even recognized as a concern or even a valid problem that did exist, you know, and he gets sent into the criminal system as a result of, you know, America's failure to recognize these things at that stage in history. And it's just, you know, to prove that I'm not the fuck up that you think I am, you know, I think would have been largely his attitude there. And then as he rose and made more enemies, there were now different people to focus that on. And I mean, you know, people talk about like, do what you love, and that's a big driving force for everyone, and that's valid. I also think that I really do think that hatred or revenge can be just as valid of a motivating factor, especially when it's combined with something that you're passionate about, like he was about music. And
and obviously somebody who's very talented. I mean, you know, the guy could put a song together. There's no doubt about that.
I would say he's an underrated musician and artist and across the board singer, writer.
Absolutely. Would you say your education was mainly gained from being out on the road and singing and performing, or did your formal schooling play a part in that?
This is going to sound cocky, but I guess I don't really care. School was always kind of a joke for me. My grandmother taught me how to read before kindergarten. And then, so I've always been an avid reader just on my own. It was never something that anyone had to force me to do. You know, other kids in class would complain when we got assigned a book report. I'd already read that book.
Right.
I was also, for the near entirety of the time that I was in school, sent to private Christian schools, which the standard for curriculum there is stupid. It's very low. The textbooks were disposable. You would write in them and rip out your pages and hand them in as homework.
Really?
It was a joke. It was an activity book. Yeah. Wow. I would do the entire year's book. I would just go home and just do it.
At the beginning of the year.
Yeah. And then have nothing to do. I would just be sitting in class just, you know, I never studied. I never did anything. I was always at the top of the class just because it was really a joke. Again, I'm not saying that I am a genius or anything, but the test that they were giving us, I was testing at a college level in third grade. I have no idea how that would translate to standardized testing in a public school system, but in this world, it was just laughable, you know. I never had to try at all. And so then you get to 12 years old, I'm getting drunk in class, you know.
Just to keep yourself from being bored out of your mind.
Because the school has a vending machine that sells Fruitopia bottles, and you can get those Franzia boxed wines that look the same exact color and fill one of those up, and then just get drunk in Spanish class because you don't have to pay attention to anything.
Right, and it's a lot more fun.
Well, and then you start getting, you know, ride home from school by the cops and things like that.
Yeah.
And it got to a situation where I was just getting in more trouble. Parents had divorced by this time, which a lot of people probably would think that has something to do with me being a troublemaker, but I doubt it. And it just got to be a problem. You know, my mom will deny it, but I think she was considering military school at one point. I went to get the mail one day and there were some pamphlets. She insisted her friend sent them to her to check them out. But I don't know about that. So I just, you know, called my dad. I was like, hey, I need to get out of here. And went back on the road full time this time. And I'm about 15 years old now. And I was on the road from 15 to 28. And I had no intention of really being a musician or joining the band at that point. But again, as we've already talked about, it wasn't long before he was like, you're in the band. And so then I had to learn how to play guitar on stage in front of everyone, which you do learn very quickly when a lot of people are watching you.
Yeah,
you know?
I would imagine.
Which is kind of what happened with this podcast, actually, too. The first episode that I made was the Spade Cooley one. Uh-huh. If you listen to that, you're listening to my first attempt at making a podcast. And I put it third because I felt like it was such an inferior attempt to where I soon graduated to. And if you listen to one of the last episodes of the first season, I think it sounds pretty good, you know?
Absolutely.
But the first three episodes to me as a listener are difficult. And it's just because I didn't know what I was doing. But also, I mean, I feel like I learned pretty quickly because everyone was paying attention, you know, it got a lot of attention right away. So I think you learn anything much more quickly if you've got a lot of people that are watching you do it.
There's a lot that you read about you not knowing how to play guitar at all when you started playing with your dad's band. Is that the case? Did you literally know nothing?
Oh, I knew which string was which and I knew how to make chords, but I mean, I became, again, I know this sounds cocky and I don't care. I became a very good guitar player while I was in the band.
The evidence is out there. Yeah.
It took a few years for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So when I say I didn't know how to play guitar, I mean, you were watching me, you know, strum, like sit down. I couldn't stand and play at the same time, sitting down, strumming an acoustic guitar. I had cheat sheets taped to the floor with the chord progressions of all the songs right there. And he never used a set list. So if he started into a song, I would be scrambling, looking on the floor to find which song we were on and then catch up on the chord progression. Right. So when I say I didn't know how to play guitar, I mean, that's ridiculous. You would never buy a ticket to a band and see something like that. You know, you just never would.
Right.
But I mean, yeah, it got to the point where I was the band leader. You know, I was, you know, handling business on stage, you know.
And were you getting paid as a regular band member at that point, like everybody else, and just one of the guys in the band?
Yeah, I think we called it an allowance at that time. Yeah. Just for certain purposes.
Yeah.
But it was kind of crazy because I didn't have any bills until I was 18. I was sleeping on the road manager's son's bedroom floor when we would have days off. Uh-huh. Yeah. Because we worked year round, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that. We didn't just, you know, tour, stop, record an album because he didn't have a record deal. He tours year round. So on the occasion that we would have some days off, he is a gambling addict. So he would go to a casino. Mm-hmm. And I'm a child. So that's not really good for me. That's not fun. And so I would go back home on the band bus with the tour manager and sleep on his son's bedroom floor. And I had no expenses. So I am just accumulating cash.
Yeah.
And I would spend most of it on books and CDs. You know, right? I would go to bookstores and just buy it. Because again, I've loved to read my entire life. And on tour, you have nothing but time to kill. I'm reading 5-6 books a week. And I would just buy them. I would spend hundreds of dollars at the bookstore. Nearly $1,000 every time I went to the music store.
Wow.
And I wish that I knew and cared about things like supporting independent businesses at this time. Unfortunately, that was almost entirely at like Best Buy.
Yeah, right.
I used to just browse the pop rock because that's where all the music except like classical was and jazz, I think. And I would just buy anything that I liked the cover of. And I found to this day some of my favorite bands just by doing that. I think that's something that's kind of gone now. I'm not going to do that on the internet. You know, I'm not going to go buy something on the internet because I like the picture that's with it.
Right.
But when you're standing there holding it, you're like, if the guys in this band or the girls in this band, whoever's in this band, if they thought this was cool, I think it's cool. So we've already got that in common.
Yeah.
And knowing nothing else about what it's supposed to sound like, I would just buy it, you know. And I mean, there was a lot of CDs I threw out the window, but there was some good stuff.
And what did your taste run toward at that time?
Very eclectic. Always have been eclectic, you know. I mean, everything from just the complete normalcy of 50s bubblegum, you know, and then take a step in this direction and you're listening to Motown, take another step and you're getting funkier with Stax, and then into the more obscure funk slash soul era of the 60s and 70s is one of my favorite time periods of music. But also, I mean, get real wild in the other direction and I'll listen to, there's this dude, Steve Reich, who's an experimental artist, and he's got this one thing. I think the actual title of it is Come Out. I want to say that the sample is a person in a police station giving testimony about getting beaten in a riot or something. And I think he's saying something along the lines, he's describing of how he like squeezed a bruise on his arm or something to let the blood come up into it to show how much blood there was in there. And he's like, and I had to let the bruised blood come out to show them. Yeah. And then Steve loops that, come out to show them, come out to show them, come out to show them. Yeah. And it's it's in stereo. It's in the left and right. And he just kicks the left and right out of phase a little bit and just lets it run for, I don't know, 15 or 17 minutes.
And develops and his hypnotic.
It just becomes cacophonous.
Show them, come out, 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 show them, come out.
You know, that's something that I just found that and listened to that and it completely blew my mind, you know, and, it's a magical time period of my life that I will always treasure, just having the option to do that. That's not something that hardly anyone is in a position to be able to do something like that. Right. And I'll never not be grateful for it, you know?
What was in your mind at that time that you're talking about? Did you think, okay, my life's going to be as a touring musician, whether it's with my dad's band or with a band I start myself or playing as a sideman for someone else, and I'm just going to be a pro and that's the way it is and it's a pretty cool life?
I had very little thinking of the future at all.
Didn't even come into your mind?
No, there was no plan. There was no, I mean, if someone just listened to everything that we've talked about so far, I think they would get the idea that I was using my time very constructively and wisely. And wow, for such a young guy on tour, he was really taking care of himself. Right. That's not
improving himself.
That's not the whole picture. I was also, you know, doing a lot of very bad things and getting arrested, you know, several times. And, you know, it's two sides of the coin, you know, and the constructive things like reading and listening to music and, you know, taking that music apart, spending time with notebooks, figuring out how song structure works and things like that. That's constructive, but that's also what you do when the bus is rolling down the road and you literally cannot get into any trouble. And then as soon as the bus stops, there's an entire world of possibility out there. And let's go see what can happen. And yeah, so.
So what changed? What was the thing? Did anything click in your mind? Was there one moment?
No. The way that my time on the road ended was just sort of this abrupt thing. I've gone into it publicly before, so I don't really want to get too deep into it now. But it basically, a bridge got burned, and the bridge that got burned was the exception of all these other bridges that were always getting burned. And it just one day, this one bridge wasn't the exception anymore. And I found myself off the road with a pretty decent criminal record, never filled out a W-2 in my life. Also, I dropped out of high school when I was 15, but I went back and got my GED to make my mom happy.
Okay.
I didn't know this, but when you get the highest score in the county, that you are actually, they award a valedictorian award. So
GED.
Yeah, I'm a dropout valedictorian. But I still couldn't get hired anywhere because they didn't want to take the time to teach me how to work a cash register, you know, just some very simple task that anyone could do. So I'm donating blood plasma twice a week.
Wow.
And I never knew music theory the entire time. I just, as far as playing guitar goes, I just figured it out. You know, I didn't take lessons and I didn't know why the things sounded the way that they did. I basically built my own map for how to get around the guitar neck. I had to give myself a crash course in music theory, essentially, in order to be able to start giving guitar lessons, which I did do. And that was kind of cool.
And how old were you at this time?
Oh, I'm 28 years old. I also have always just been kind of good at social media. I'm the only person in the band in the age bracket to even have social media, you know, for the most of the time I'm in the band. So essentially, if you're a David Allan Coe fan and you want to keep up with what's happening on tour, and I'm not like announcing tour dates or doing anything, you know, functionally contributing
conventional,
nothing that's actually helping them.
Yeah.
But if they just want some sort of activity on social media, it was usually just me that they would end up following, because there was never a, you know, an official David Allen Coe Facebook page or anything like that. So I just kind of got good at doing that, and I figured out, oh, well, there's got to be a way to make money with this. And, you know, you get into digital marketing and start looking at things like that. I did some like freelance PR work for some independent record labels, which that was kind of cool. And all of this was just in order to fulfill my obligation that I had with my roommates. I had signed a lease in this house, you know, and I needed to keep paying rent there until I could come back here to Nashville, where I had more connections in, you know, an industry where my experience means something, you know, as opposed to, no, we're not going to hire you at Bennigan's because you don't know So I came here, and I didn't want to be in another band. I'm not going to get in a van and start from the bottom and, you know, try to get people to pay attention to something that I really don't even think I have anything to say at that point, you know? So, it was the live concert business, live music business is what's happening here in Nashville. So I just showed up at this venue, and I was like, hey, I'm going to come here for, you know, free. You're not paying me. I'm just showing up a couple days a week. Right. They had an intern program. So there were college kids doing this.
Yeah.
I'm a decade older than them, but I'm also doing this, you know? And my plan was, I'm going to learn how, I know exactly how all of this works from the artist side, the touring artist side. I'm going to learn how this works from the other side. Then I'll have the bigger picture, which, you know, it's the whole work your way up from the mailroom mentality. Yeah. If you start there and get to the top, you know how everyone's job is done. So you know when they're doing it right. While I was there, the general manager put in his 2 weeks notice and said that, he's like, hey, they're, because I wasn't getting paid again. I was just showing up for free. He was like, hey, they're definitely going to offer you a position here. I'm doing this music business startup over here, and I would love it if you would come to do that instead. And that seemed less like having a boss. That seemed more, it seemed like a bigger move, you know?
Yeah.
And I had told myself I could do this for a year. You know, I didn't have a lot of money at all, barely anything. But I had told myself when I came to Nashville, I can do whatever I have to do for a year and not get paid, and then we may have a problem, you know, and that year wasn't up yet. So I still had time to take a gamble. Yeah. And so I went with that, and that didn't really work out. It's not really anyone's fault. I think personal things came up for different people, and no one really had a problem with each other. It was just like outside external things in their personal lives. And, so I started looking for something I could do for myself. And I don't know if you have seen this, but I started this website called drunkmall.com.
I did see that. Mm-hmm.
That kind of got a lot of attention.
Yeah, that was so for those who were unaware, describe that, you know, basically what that was.
It's if we didn't have Wi-Fi on the tour bus when I was touring, and we didn't have Wi-Fi on airplanes when I was touring. Yeah. And I'm the kind of person where I am going to get drunk if I'm going to get on an airplane, you know, that's just going to happen. And if they had Wi-Fi when I was on planes all the time, my credit would have been screwed from day one just because of the Sky Mall magazine, you know? And I don't know how they, I mean, I guess Sky Mall actually went bankrupt now. So I guess they don't have Sky Mall on planes now, but can you imagine the credit card situations people would be getting themselves into
nowadays? Yeah,
man. But I was just like, man, I mean, well, you don't need to be on a plane now. And you hear stories about people getting drunk and buying something dumb on the internet.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, there's gotta be a website like that. And there just wasn't, you know, no one had made this website. I was like, well, I can make that website. And so I did, and it got a lot of attention, and that was bringing in money. That was what I was doing for money.
Yeah.
And the reason why I wanted to do that, I forgot to say, was because I wanted to find something where I didn't need to collaborate.
Okay.
I wanted to find something where I was the only person who needed to show up every day.
That makes sense.
And it was great. It did not take, I mean, it took work, but not like, you know, construction or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I could actually get drunk and do it. And in fact, it kind of helped because I was,
you're in the mindset.
I was writing for drunk people on the internet. It's unethical. Who cares? But also I tend to pay attention to what's coming down the pipeline, you know, and, artificial intelligence is coming. Automation is coming. Mm-hmm. I know that everything that I was doing with Drunk Mall, I'd like to entertain the notion that my creativity has a lot to do with why it worked or whatever. Yeah. Probably not. Well, it's probably just the stupid stuff and funny stuff that I'm finding and putting on the website, you know, and 100% an algorithm can do that, you know, tomorrow probably.
Well,
we could probably design it now. We probably don't even have to wait for the technology to get weird. But when the technology gets weird, it's happening and no one needs me. So just on the back burner, I was trying to just kind of half-ass cast a net. Just what else? Be thinking of something else. Just be okay. Looking for another opportunity, something else.
Yeah, take this job, son. I'm not working here no more. Yeah, my woman done left. She took all the reasons I was working for. And you better not try to stand in my way when I'm walking out the door. You can take this job and shove it. I'm not working here no more.
So there we are, Jim. We kind of, left Tyler there after he had left his father's band and was sort of doing some strange things on the side. You heard him talk about his website, drunkmall.com. Really, really, we kind of heard how his formative years went, how he kind of ended up living by himself in Nashville. And he's really at the stage now where he's primed to begin making this podcast.
I'm on that website right now looking to order a Centipede mini arcade game.
It looks pretty good, doesn't
it? It's going to be coming to my house. Okay, so tomorrow we're going to hear more about the podcast itself, more about Cocaine and Rhinestones,
right? We're
really
going to dig into it, yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm very excited.
It's going
to
be great.
First, why don't we tell people where they can hear Cocaine and Rhinestones? It's like all the same places, I think, that you can hear Rock in the Suburbs,
same
right?
Same places, yeah.
Just search for that. That's right. And he has a website for the show?
Yeah, cocaineandrhinestones.com. And everything's there. You can actually listen to the episodes. You can also look at the transcript. And he does something that we'll hear a little bit more about tomorrow called liner notes at the end of every episode.
Oh, cool.
So you can hear those there. And you can even follow him on social media and get into this this raffle he does where he kind of raffles off his research material, which is kind of neat.
Oh yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. Okay. All right. And then as I mentioned, listen to Rock in the Suburbs.
Every day.
We're on every day. Mm-hmm. And you can find us on all the big podcast platforms, all the same places. And you can find our website, it's suburbspod.com, where we have not transcripts.
No.
I don't think anybody would want to read that.
No.
Our ramblings. But they do have, just a few like little show notes on every episode.
Yeah, we do.
And listings of the songs that we play.
Yeah.
So you can find those.
The big list.
Things like that. Also, you can call us and leave a voice message. And if you want to, get your voice on the show in the future, it's the Suburban Party Line at
612-440-1984.
Or email us rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at suburbspod. Mm-hmm. All right, let's get out of here.
All right.
And we'll hear more from Tyler tomorrow.
Early one morning while making the rounds, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. I went right home and I went to bed. I stuck at 11:44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed that gun, took a shot of cocaine and away I run. Made a good run, but I run too slow. They overtook me down in Juarez, Mexico. Laid in the hot joints, taking the pill. In walked the sheriff from Jericho Hill. He said, Willie Lee, your name is not Jack Brown. You're the dirty hack that shot your woman down. And yes, oh yes, my name is Willie Lee. If you've got a warrant, just to read it to me. Shut her down because she made me slow. I thought I was her daddy, but she had five more.
Yeah, I'm a dropout valedictorian.